An Osho Talk. The great Zen master, Tahui. Reflections on the transformation of an intellectual to enlightenment. Number 25.
Two awakenings. In the old days, the Venerable Yan Yang asked Chao Chu, "What's it like when not bringing a single thing?" Chao said, "Put it down." Yan Yang said, "Since not a single thing is brought, put what down?" Charles said, "If you can't put it down, pick it up." At these words, Yan Yang was greatly enlightened. Again, a monk asked an ancient worthy, "What's it like when the student can't cope?" The ancient worthy said, "I too am like this." The monk said, "Teacher, why can't you cope either?" The ancient worthy said, "If I could cope, I could take away this inability to cope of yours." At these words, the monk was greatly enlightened. The enlightenment of these two monks is precisely where you are lost. Where you have doubts is exactly where these two monks asked their questions. Phenomena are born from discrimination and also perish through discrimination. Wipe out all phenomena of discrimination. This Dharma has no birth or destruction.
Zen is special in many ways. From other traditions of the mystics, the one thing that stands out very unique is strange small dialogues just reading them you cannot find how those small dialogues can bring enlightenment to someone. Secondly, Zen gives no explanations itself. That is one of the reasons a living tradition of enlightenment has not overtaken the whole world. I would like you to understand those small dialogues which apparently mean nothing. But in a certain circumstance produced by other Zen methods, they can bring awakening. The dialogues are remembered down the centuries, and the people on the path of Zen enjoy them immensely. But for outsiders, they remain anathema. Because the context is never told. In what reference the awakening happened is never discussed. Behind these small dialogues, there is a long discipline of meditation, understanding, maybe years and years of work. But only the dialogue is known to the outside world. You don't know the men who are discussing with each other. They are not ordinary people. The awakening is possible only if they have a background which can make the small piece of dialogue, which in itself is nothing, of tremendous importance. But when you read it, you cannot believe how these dialogues can make somebody enlightened. And you are reading them and you are not becoming enlightened. So something is not in your perspective. My effort will be to give you the whole context and not only to explain the words of the dialogue, but the individuals who are engaged in these small dialogues. Only then you will see they are not small things. They are the very optimum. Those people have reached to the last point. These dialogues are just a little push. They were almost ready. It can be said that even without these dialogues, they were going to become enlightened maybe a week later. These dialogues have cut not more than 1 week from their being enlightened. All around the world, now that Zen has become fashionable and there are so much written about it, and nobody I have come across up to now, and I have seen almost everything that has been written about Zen by people who don't have any enlightenment, but who are impressed by the beauty of the people who have been following Zen. So they have picked up things which make no sense, are almost nonsense, and they don't have the capacity to give you the background. And remember, everything depends on the background. The long years of preparation are there. Long years of waiting, longing, long years of silent patience, meditating, and this dialogue comes at the apex, at the very end. If you can understand the whole process, then the dialogue will be explained to you that it can bring enlightenment to someone. Without knowing the whole process, Zen will remain just entertainment in the world. What is enlightenment to the Zen people falls down into a state of entertainment. These are not the whole thing. It is just like an iceberg. A small piece is showing above the sea. 1/10 of the whole iceberg. 9/10 is underneath. And unless you understand that 9/10, this 1/10 will not give you any insight. In the old days, says Tahui, the venerable and young asked Chao Chu, what is it like when not bringing a single thing? Charles said, put it down. And Yang said, since not a single thing is brought, put what down? Chao said, if you can't put it down, pick it up. At these words, Anyang was greatly enlightened. Now, if you remain confined to this small anecdote, you cannot explain how it can bring great enlightenment. The context of the whole Zen approach. In the eyes of Gautam Buddha, Bodhidharma, Tahui. The world is nothing but emptiness. And when they use the word emptiness, they have their own meaning. It does not mean ordinary meaning that you can find in a dictionary. If in your room everything is removed out, the whole furniture, the photographs hanging on the wall, the chandelier and everything, nothing is left behind, anybody will say, this room is empty. This is our ordinary meaning of the word. But from the perspective of Gautam Buddha, this room is empty of things. But this room is full of space. In fact, when things were there, they were hindering the space. The very word room means space. So it is overflowing now with his space, nothing to hinder. Nothing to prevent and obstruct the space. And space is not a negative thing like the word emptiness denotes. Everything in the world has come out of the space, and everything disappears into the space. A space seems to be the reservoir of all that is. Now scientists say they have discovered few years before black holes in the space. It is the most amazing story that science has to tell. They themselves feel embarrassed, but what they can do? They have come across few places in the space . The moment any star, even the biggest star, comes into their area, you cannot see them. They are just pure nothingness. Their pull is so tremendous that anything that comes close to them immediately is pulled in the black hole and it disappears from the world. And every day many stars continue disappearing into black holes. That was the basic idea. But then certainly scientists started thinking, if there are black holes, there must be white holes too. Because if everything goes on disappearing into the black holes, one day all will be disappeared. But every day new stars are being born. From where they come, it is still an assumption, a hypothesis, that from wherever they come, that place should be called White Hole. My own understanding is that the black hole and the white hole are just two sides of the same . They are not separate. It is just like a door. You can go in, you can go out. On the door, one side is written Puss, and on another side is written Pull. The black hole decreates. It is a death. Not only you get tired and old, now they say even metals get tired. Even a machinery working 24 hours is not right. You are creating too much tension in the metal. It needs a little rest. To recover itself, otherwise soon it will be not in a state of functioning anymore. Even machines become old just as men. Stars become old just anything else. When a star or a planet has become too old and cannot hold itself together anymore, it disappears into a black hole. Its death has come. It is decreation. The function of the black hole is to disperse all constituents of the planet or the star into their original form. And the original form is nothing but electricity, just energy. So matter melts into energy. And you cannot see it. Energy cannot be seen. Have you ever seen electricity? You have seen a byproduct of electricity, that your light bulb is there, but you have not seen electricity itself. When it is passing through a wire line, do you see anything? And if the bulb is removed, electricity is still there, but do you see it? No energy can be seen. No energy is visible. So when the whole matter of a vast a star or a planet falls back into the original source, it becomes pure energy. That's why you cannot see it. It has disappeared. Perhaps it was time for a long rest. And once it is rested, then the basic constituents can again come together, can again form a new body and get out into the universe from the other side of the black hole, that is the white hole. This is very significant today in the minds of physicists, that it means universe is continuously renewing itself in the same way as every individual is born, grows old, dies, and then somewhere else he is born. In a new form, fresh, young. This is the process of rejuvenation. The existence itself is full of space. But space looks empty to us. It is not empty. It is only potential for things sometimes to happen. Everything has come out of it. Hence, how can you call it empty? Can you call a mother's womb empty? It has the potential of giving birth to life. It appears empty because its potentiality has not been transformed into actuality. Gautam Buddha is the first man to use the word emptiness in the sense of spaciousness, infinite space. Everything is just a form. And the thing that is creating the form is invisible. Only the form is visible, but the energy that makes it is invisible. The Zen disciple meditates continuously on the emptiness of existence, on the spaciousness of existence. All forms are empty. No form has a self. Only existence has a self. All others are only dreams lasting for few years, and in the eternity of time, few years are not much to brag about. They don't matter at all. The meditator continuously goes on and on into realizing the nature and the flavor of nothingness. The day he understands that everything phenomenal that appears will disappear. Today it is, tomorrow it may be gone. It is nothing eternal. And unless something is eternal, it is not real. Getting deep into this meditation, it will change your whole life. Anger comes and you know that it is just an energy form. You don't pay attention to the person against whom you are angry. The meditator pays his whole attention to anger itself. The form disappears, and the energy contained in the form is absorbed by the meditator. As things go on disappearing, sadness, tensions, unhappiness, misery, he goes on becoming more and more powerful. Because everything is falling back into the form of energy. In this state, you try to understand the first anecdote. Master En Yang asked Chao Chu, "What is it like when not bringing a single thing? It is just customary. Both are adepts. One has already become enlightened. The other is just on the verge. And it is respectful to bring something as a present to the master." But Chao Chu asks, "What is it like when not bringing a single thing?" He has not brought any present to the master. And he is asking the master himself what it is like, how it feels. When you come to the master without a single thing as a present, Chao said, "Put it down." Logically, it is absolutely absurd answer. When you have not brought anything, what is there to put down? But there is something, and it is not absent. And Young has asked, what is it like, how it feels? When not bringing a single thing. And when Chao said, put it down, he is saying, put whatsoever it feels like, put it down. He is not saying about anything to put it down. That much is understood between the both. That how can you put down which you have not brought? But you are feeling something, put that feeling down. Get rid of it. Because all things are empty forms. Whether you bring them or not, you never bring anything. It is always nothingness either. Potential nothingness or actual nothingness, but it is nothingness. So don't be bothered about it. Whatever is your feeling, there is no need to discuss about it. You just put it down. Get free of it. And Young said, since not a single thing is brought, put what down? It is not that he has not understood. It is not your question that he is asking. He is a man of meditation, and he understands exactly what Chao means when he says, put it down. But he is teasing the master. He wants him to say something which is not right, so that then he can catch hold of his neck. And he has raised such a question in which anybody can be caught. And this is an old playfulness in the tradition of Zen. Since not a single thing is brought, put what down? He is making a logical statement. Knowing perfectly well what he means when he says, put it down. But you cannot defeat a master. Chao said, if you cannot put it down, pick it up. But he remains in his state of pure nothingness. He does not move a single bit. Although the disciple is trying to move him and say something, but an enlightenment an awakened consciousness cannot be tricked into anything. You can try it from every corner, and there are thousands of stories in which disciples had been trying to pull the leg of the master. But Nobody has ever succeeded. If somebody succeeds, that means the master is not a master yet. He is a pretender. So when he asks, put what down? He has made a logical statement and he is trying to prove that what master is saying is absurd. But the master cannot be moved from his state of being. He says, okay, if you cannot put it down, pick it up. But the situation remains the same. The question can be asked again, that if I have not brought anything, how can I pick it up? But Anyang understood that it is enough. You cannot trick the master into making a statement which is not according to his experience of nothingness. There is nothing to pick it up, and there is nothing to put it down. But the feeling that you are carrying, either put it down. If you cannot put it down, then pick it up. What else can be said? This absurd statement, looking absurd to any outsider, suddenly triggers in the disciple who is just on the verge of enlightenment the same light, the same understanding, that there is nothing to carry, nothing to put down, nothing to pick up. Only you are a pure awareness into an ocean of nothingness. Listening it from the master, Chao, it goes directly as an arrow to his being. At these words, Anyang was greatly enlightened. I would like to give you another instance which is more clear. To understand, and which will help to understand this instance. One great king, Prasenjita, a contemporary of Gautam Buddha, was going to receive him outside the city to the main door. And he has a very precious diamond. Which was unique, and all the kings of this country were jealous about that diamond. So he thought, what can be an appropriate present to Buddha coming into my city? So I will take this diamond. His wife was a long time follower of Gautam Buddha, even before she was married to Prasenjita. In fact, Prasenjita was going only because the wife was insisting that it is a precious moment. Don't miss it. And he wanted to show deep down to the world his generosity, his ego, by offering the great diamond. On the surface, it was one thing that he is so polite, so nice, so humble, that he has brought the greatest valuable present. But deep down in the unconscious it was that thousands of monks will be there. 10,000 monks used to move with Gautam Buddha wherever he went. And the whole capital will be there to receive. So it is a good chance to show his wealth, his power, his generosity, the wife could see it in his eyes. He said, listen, to Gautam Buddha, this is just a stone. Don't think that he will be impressed by it. My feeling is that in our pond in the palace, there is a beautiful lotus flower. You take that. That will mean much more to him than a dead stone. He said, I will take both and I will see whether you are right or I am right. He reached with his wife, and of course he was the king, so he was ahead of the whole crowd of the people who had come to receive Buddha. He brought the diamond before him, that I am not very rich, but I have one of the most precious diamonds, and I offer it to you. Buddha said, drop it. He could not believe. But before thousands of people, when Buddha says, drop it, he cannot even resist or say no. he had to drop it. And he thought perhaps his wife was right, that to Buddha it is just a stone. To you it is a very precious thing. Then he raised from another hand the lotus flower. And Buddha says, drop it. He said, my God, my wife is also wrong. So he dropped the lotus flower. And now there was nothing to present. Just with empty hands he was standing there. Buddha said, drop it. Now this was too much. When there is nothing left, what he can drop? And Mahakashyapa started laughing. Mahakashyapa is the first originator of Zen. He is really the founder. But because he never spoke, all that is mentioned once in a while is his laughter. Prasenjita looked at Mahakashyap. He himself was a son of a great king who has renounced his kingdom and followed Gautam Buddha. He said, Mahakashyapa, why are you laughing? He said, I am laughing because you don't know the understanding of what Buddha is saying. To understand him, a deep experience of meditation is needed. He is not saying that drop the diamond or drop the lotus flower. They are just forms. Drop yourself. Unless you drop yourself, you don't drop anything. Fall into his feet. This was too much. Prasenjita has not thought about it. He has brought presents. He was not a follower. His wife was, but now before so many people, it looked awkward, not. He touched with his head Gautam Buddha's feet, and this time Gautam Buddha laughed. He said, you are pretending to drop, but not dropping. There is no need to pretend here. Either be authentic or don't do it. Now take up your diamond and your lotus flower and get lost. If you cannot drop yourself, there is no other present that you can bring to me. Unless you are the present itself, no present is acceptable. Only love can be a present. Only a deep let go can be a presence. Only merging with the one who has arrived can be a presence. All presences are just too ordinary. Even to bring them is to show your stupidity. Listening to him, seeing to him, he had seen Buddha for the first time. Feeling the energy field around him, he has never been silent. For the first time he was feeling silent, and thousands of people were utterly silent, as if there was nobody else. He second time touched Gautam Buddha's feet, and Gautam Buddha said, now it is right. It is coming from your very heart. Now I can accept your presence. Although for the ordinary person it will be a question, what presence? Because the diamond has been rejected, the lotus flower has been rejected. And Buddha is accepting the present now. For the ordinary mind, nothing is transferred anymore, but to the perception of the enlightened one, everything has happened. Prasenjita is no more the same man. He did not return home back. He said to his wife, I am puzzled that you have been long, long a disciple of Gautam Buddha. Then why you got married? Then why you are still in the palace? When your master is moving barefoot in the hot sun around the country, you should be with him, you should take care of him. You can go back home, the chariot is ready, but I have dropped myself. I have given myself as a present. I am not coming home. The wife had not thought of such a possibility. She was a disciple, but that does not mean but now when the husband is not going, she also raises to a state of consciousness. She said, you cannot defeat me. I also belong to the same race of warriors as you belong. Defeat is simply not acceptable. Death is acceptable, but defeat, no. I am also going to remain. The chariot can go back empty. This dropping will help you to understand the dialogue between Anyang and Chao. He's saying, don't carry any tension. If you have not brought anything, it doesn't matter. Because when you brought anything, then too it doesn't matter. So put it down. This whole feeling that you have not brought anything, this whole guilt, this whole embarrassment, put it down. But when he says that when I have not brought anything, how can I put it down? Chao said, then it is up to you. Pick it up. At that very moment, as if like a sudden lightning, he could see what he means. He is not talking about anything. He is talking about the tense mind. Either put it down, if you cannot. It is said, but it is okay, pick it up. An immediate understanding arose in him, and Yang was greatly enlightened. If you can see the whole background, how meditation functions, how masters of meditation have functioned. And remember, Chao would not have said this to anybody or everybody. It is certainly and Yang's state that is clear to Chao. When you come before the master, he knows where you are. Seeing that just a small thought is preventing him into entering the great nothingness. He answered this way. Otherwise he would not have answered. If a professor was visiting, a scientist was visiting, a logician was visiting, he would not have said that. It was pointless. The other man was not ready for it. That's why I have been continuously saying to you, I don't answer to your questions, I answer to you. The question is irrelevant. The questioner is my target, not his question. So it is possible the same question may be asked by different people, and I may answer differently, because the questioner is different. Different people can phrase the question in the same way, in the same words, but different people cannot ask the same question, because those different individuals have a different state of consciousness, and I have to answer to their consciousness, not to their rubbish that comes out of the mind. This creates a problem. For anybody who wants to work out what my philosophy is going to be soon in an insane asylum. Because he will find so many answers for the same question, he is going to be crazy, nuts. Because it is not a philosophy. It is not a consistent logical system. It is individual to individual, intimate transfer of some energy, of some light. Again, a monk asked an ancient worthy, what is it like when the student can't cope? The ancient worthy said, I too am like this. This was strange, as far as the mind is concerned. Because the master is saying that I am also like this. A student cannot cope, that is understandable. But the master saying, I too am like this, leads you in a dimension which is not of logic. It is of existence itself. The monk said, teacher, why can't you cope either? The ancient worthy said, if I could cope, I could take away this inability to cope of yours. At these words, the monk was greatly enlightened. First, the monk asked about somebody else, which the master can see directly. He wants to ask a question about himself, but is not courageous to ask it. I have come across thousands of times people bringing that my friend has this problem. And I have told them always, it is better you send your friend, and he can say that My friend has the problem. If you cannot even accept that it is your problem, you don't deserve any answer. You are not authentic even in your question. He says, what is it like when the student can't cope? On the path, master's time has not to be wasted about others. Rare moments you should ask about yourself. And he is really asking, what is it like when I cannot cope? But is cowardly. The ancient worthy said, I too am like this. Now the thing becomes even more puzzling. First, the questioner is not opening his heart, and he thinks whatever the master answers will be applicable to him too. And what the master answers is, I too am like this. This makes no sense. The monk said, teacher, why can't you cope either? It is okay for a disciple, for a student, but for you? You are a master. You have already arrived. Why you can't cope? And the ancient worthy said, if I could cope, I could take away this inability to cope of yours. He is not talking about the student. He is not talking about anybody else. He directly hits him, which he was hiding. Behind the word student, he himself was standing. The master says, if I could cope, I could take away this inability to cope of yours. If I cannot take it away, that simply means I myself can't cope. I am not a real master. Before a false student, how I can be a real master? I can expose my reality only to one who is authentic towards me. He has caught hold of the man. He says, I could take away this inability to cope of yours. It must have been a sudden shock that he was asking about somebody else and he is answering him. And that sudden shock stops the functioning of the mind. Anything sudden, and the mind cannot manage. It can manage only with that which is stale and old, perfectly known to it. It can repeat like a parrot the old answer. But now what to do? The master has caught him red-handed cheating. A silence, a shock, but the shock and the silence has helped immensely. At these words, the monk was greatly enlightened. The enlightenment of these two monks is precisely where you are lost, where you have doubts. Is exactly where these two monks ask their questions. Phenomena are born from discrimination and also perish through discrimination. Wipe out all phenomena of discrimination. This dharma has no birth or destruction. This path, this alchemy of Zen has no birth and no destruction. And it is one of the most direct transformation from the master to the disciple. It does not go into long verbiage. It does not discuss unnecessary problems. Zen has reduced everything to the very essential. It has cut everything that was not necessary. Zen is like a telegram. And have you noticed the fact when you write a letter, it goes on becoming longer and longer. It is easy to start the letter. It is difficult where to end it. But when you give a telegram, then just 10 words. It is a condensed message. Your 10-page long letter will not have the same effect as 10 words of a telegram. Because the more condensed the meaning is, the more striking, the more spread the meaning is, the less impressive. Zen believes in the very essentials, it has no nonsense around it, no rituals. In which all other religions have got lost. No chanting, no mantras, no scriptures, just small anecdotes. If you have the right awareness, they will hit you directly in the heart. It is very condensed and crystallized teaching. But it needs the person to be prepared for it. And the only preparation is meditative awareness. You cannot teach Zen in universities. It is difficult for the simple reason because the students don't have the meditative awareness. And you don't have books on Zen which can make that which looks absurd meaningful. You will be surprised that in many Zen universities they are teaching Zen through my books. Because my books are at least making an effort of the absurd to make it appear sensible. I am trying to give a context, the right background, because I am talking to people who are not born in the Zen tradition. So Zen books themselves are very fragmentary. I have never been to Japan, and most probably the government of Japan won't allow me. But in many universities, because in Japan the Zen monasteries, the bigger ones always have a university attached to the monastery, where the Zen monks can teach. It is simply strange that it is their tradition and they have almost 1200 years passed with great literature, paintings, poems, but they are all fragmentary. And nobody has tried to give not just the conclusion, but the whole context. It was very strange when I was arrested in America. The first telegram reached from a Zen master from Japan, protesting to the president that this is absolutely ugly of your country to arrest a man who has not committed any crimes and who cannot commit any crimes. Although we don't know him personally, but we teach from his books in our university. And the insight that he has brought to Zen is so clear that it is not possible that the man has not reached to the same space as Gautam Buddha. You have arrested a Gautam Buddha. Please immediately release him. It will be a condemnation for you and your country forever. The jailer immediately came to me and he showed me the telegram. A copy was sent to me and a copy to the president. Just now in Japan, they are having a great festival of sannyasins. Everybody else is also invited. Thousands of people are going together. Mostly will be monks, people who are meditating, but are somewhere struck. People who have been reading, but cannot find the right explanation. All absurd statements appear only absurd to the mundane mind. Once you have risen above your mundane mediocrity, once you can see clearly, the absurdity disappears. And not only the absurdity disappears, its disappearance will be a disappearance of your own ego too. Your mind too will disappear with it. These small dialogues and stories have served so many people to attain enlightenment that great scriptures have not been able to do. Great scriptures have created only scholars. There is no place for scholars in Zen. For example, these two stories, what a scholar is to do with them? But a scholar is perfectly at ease with Vedas, with Gita, with Bible, with Talmud, Torah. He is very at ease. Because those are 10-page letters and these are telegrams. Urgent, immediate, not giving you any explanation, but simply giving you the very essence, the perfume of thousands of flowers. Just you have to be alert and meditative to absorb them. If you can absorb them, in the whole world literature, there is nothing more important than Zen anecdotes. In everything, they are unique. There are small paintings. Just watching them, and you will fall into such a peace that you cannot conceive to get from a Picasso. Watching to Picasso, you will get such nightmares in the night. But watching to a Zen painting, which is very simple, you will have a great peace descending on you. There are great poetries, but not of the same significance as a small haikus from Zen. I have always loved Vaso, one of the haiku masters. His small haikus say so much that even a whole 1,000-page holy scripture does not say. It is all so much prose. A small haiku of Vaso is the ancient pond, and when you hear the haiku, you have to visualize, because it is so small that it is not a question of understanding, it is a question of entering into it. The ancient pond. Just have the feel of an ancient pond. Visualize it. The ancient pond, a frog jumps in, plop, and the haiku is complete. But he has said so much. The ancient pine, pond, the ancient trees, the ancient rocks around it. And there must be silence. And a frog jumps in. For a moment, the silence is disturbed. Plop. And again the silence is restored. Perhaps deeper than it was before. What he wants to say in this haiku is saying this ancient world and your existence is just a plow, a little sound in the silence, and then you are gone, and the silence deepens. In this way he makes the whole world ephemeral, dreamlike, nothing solid in it. Except the great silence that great silence is your very being, and it is also the very being of the whole universe.